First, though, it's time for Correspondence Report with Thomas Ariti.
Thanks, Hugh. Welcome to the program. One of the hallmarks of the Trump era has been the attacks on the media. The press has had a revered role in American society dating back to the revolution, but it's under attack like never before. And as North America correspondent Connor Duffy found out, that poses unique challenges for journalists.
You know, CNN, fake news, MSNBC, you know, that's really the enemy of the people.
For reporters in the Trump age, it's a familiar insult. Travel anywhere in Trump counties, and even as you try to tell supporters stories, you're bound to get criticised, like this American reporter in Florida.
Get your down there and you interview her. Give her the respect she needs. If you're not here to interview military, leave. You're here about Hillary Clinton. We're here about Trump and our military. No, you're here about justice. Because you don't have a heart.
The odd thing is that America is actually a great place to report. The First Amendment free speech protections give a presumption in favour of media access that makes our working lives easier on a daily basis. President Trump, though, is eroding that with comments like this.
It's time to expose the crooked media deceptions and to challenge the media for their role in fomenting divisions. And yes, by the way, they are trying to take away our history and our heritage. You see that.
The media has long been part of that history and heritage. One of my favourite museums in Washington, D.C. is the Newseum, which, among many other things, documents the role the press played in assisting American revolutionaries. Five-time Emmy Award-winning anchor Mike Walter, who works at CGTN America, says the Founding Fathers intended the media's watchdog role to be part of the fabric of American society.
Freedom of the press clearly was important to the people who created this nation, and it's been that way forever. I mean, there's no other profession that's, protected in the Constitution. So I think even the founders understood the importance of a free press and the role that it plays in keeping, a government going the way it should. I mean, our job is to speak truth to power and kind of put their feet to the fire. So it's vitally important.
Contrast that with this often repeated line from President Trump.
These are really, really dishonest people, and they're bad people. And I really think they don't like our country. I really believe that.
Recently, the museum came under fire for continuing to sell Make America Great Again hats and merchandise. After a backlash, they withdrew the items from sale, something I think could fan the flames of hostility from President Trump supporters. Mike Walter says the president's unconventional attacks leave the media unsure about how to cover the president, even down to describing whether or not he's lying.
Kind of the problem for journalists is how do you report on an untraditional president, which he is. I think you see every variation. You see a lot of them taking him on. You see others just kind of playing it straight. And I think we're in uncharted territory. And I think journalists are trying to figure out how to navigate this territory as well. We do see, the Washington Post recently with their fact checker said that the president lied. You know, and I think a lot of times journalists don't want to say that. They say untruth or he's fudging the facts and that sort of thing. And I'm not sure how that's going to play either.
Added to this is the fragmentation of the media, with CNN and MSNBC trying to cater to a more left-wing audience, while Fox News is a comfortable home for conservatives. This ability to label hard truths fake, even if they are just something you disagree with, is increasingly making it harder for the traditional journalistic role of speaking truth to power. Mike Walters says the combination of a president on the attack, at the same time this media trend is accelerating, is a dangerous combination.
You know, you continue to report the news, but then people say, well, no, it's fake. You know, it's not real. And the other thing that we have here in the U.S. that I think is also disquieting is we have different news networks that kind of cater to different points of view. And so what they cover a lot of times, I mean, you can watch, I get off the air some nights and I'll walk by a bank of television monitors and you might watch on CNN or MSNBC about the coverage of the Cohen indictment or the Cohen plea, I should say, and the Manafort verdict. And yet on Fox News, it'll say the dangers of the two-tier judicial system, you know, and they're talking about something entirely different. So, you know, when you mix all of that in and then you throw in the president claiming fake news, you have a lot of, I think, confused citizens who don't even know where to go for the news. And then when they do hear things they don't want to hear, they say, well, it's simply not true.
The president's message about the media clearly resonates, though, and shows journalists have a trust gap to bridge with at least part of their audience. Mike Walter witnessed the September 11 attack on the Pentagon and says some media consumers will never be satisfied.
Well, you know, I'd like to say it's extraordinarily unusual, and obviously it is when it's the president of the United States, but the fake news, you know, in terms of those kinds of claims, I've been a victim of it for more than a decade. You know, on 9/11, I saw the jet go into the Pentagon, and shortly after, all the conspiracy theories began to flourish. And I mean, I just got a tweet probably a couple of months ago from somebody who said, you know, how does it feel having the blood of the innocents on your hands, you know, lying about what happened on 9/11, or does your cushy job make it okay? So I've been listening to this kind of fake news drumbeat for years and years and years.
Those grievances have never been fanned by a sitting president, and the unique reporting challenges will continue as Donald Trump promises to continue adding to the fire.
When the media lies to people, I will never, ever let them get away with it. I will do whatever I can that they don't get away with it. They have their own agenda, and their agenda is not your agenda.
The US President Donald Trump there, and Connor Duffy with that report from Washington. Every week on this program, we hear stories from our correspondents based all over the world, and there's no denying that covering global news can be challenging. In today's media landscape, there are multiple platforms journalists need to be aware of, often all at once, and that requires a unique skill set involving different technology and software on the road. But then there's the personal life of a correspondent, moving their families to the other side of the world as they pursue their love of international news. So what's going through the mind of someone who's about to embark on that journey? Well, before he hopped on a plane to London, I caught up with our new Europe correspondent, Linton Besser, to ask just that. Linton Besser, congratulations on your posting. Does it fulfill a lifelong ambition?
Oh, it certainly does. I think I first wanted to do foreign reporting, you know, probably almost 20 years ago now when I was a segment producer at Channel 9 for the Today Show. Right. And at the time, the correspondents were Carl Stefanovic and Michael Usher. Okay. And they were, you know, in far-flung places. I think Michael Usher was in London and Carl Stefanovic was in America. And actually, still to this day, one of the most compelling things I've ever seen broadcasted was a morning when Michael Usher was at that awful school shooting in Chechnya, I think it was, or in Beslan.
Yeah, Beslan, yeah.
And just seeing the professionalism with which he navigated telling that story and the way that it came home, I thought, oh, God, I wonder if I'd ever be up for that. So now I'll find out.
Yeah, now you find out. So what's going through your mind at the moment? Because you'll be based in London, but you're covering a pretty significant part of the world. Is it a daunting prospect?
It's incredibly daunting. It's daunting just getting there, but I think it's about 50 countries from where? From Portugal to Turkey. And following in the tradition of such a fine stable of reporters that have worked over there for the ABC for so long. And, you know, I was in a story meeting yesterday, and of course the prospect of regeneration in the royal family came up. Right, one of these things we have to prepare for, I guess. And yes, and I'm certainly no expert when it comes to the British monarchy, so you know, any suggestions for a good book to read to get myself up to speed, I'd welcome, Tom.
So what issues interest you the most in Europe then?
I think we're at a remarkable moment in Europe where questions are being asked about whether this is the end of the European experiment. Of course, Brexit is the kind of big headline event, but right across Europe, from Spain to Italy, certainly, and Austria, prominent political leaders are thrashing it out over the terms of their European bonds. And all of this, of course, amidst the heightened drama of Russia flexing its muscles and the global economy really shifting on its Asian axis, you know, I think we're coming up to a period of great flux. There's great uncertainty, I think, in Western Europe. You know, in a lot of these economies, youth unemployment has been so bad for so long that now those young kids are now in their middle age, I guess, and they're the ones voting for the rise of the far right and other and the far left fringe parties. All of that, I think, is very much in the mix.
A big task and a lot of issues ahead. So let's explore what a new correspondent does in the lead up to a posting like this. These days, a correspondent has to keep across multiple platforms, keep them in mind at all times. What have you been doing to prepare?
Mostly sweating. I tried yesterday in my amateurism to build a spreadsheet of all of the ABC programs that I'm going to be servicing, and I quickly ran out of rows in the in the spreadsheet, and I kind of abandoned the experiment. But no, I look, I've been going around the building meeting all the various bosses of all the programs who very rightly see their program as really important, and they all are, and they all have slightly different appetites and slightly different demands, and they all want a piece of correspondence, and that's to be expected. It's a big investment to have people overseas, and so I really want to do my best to, you know, give all of them exactly what they want, the kinds of stories that their listeners and their viewers and their readers want to be consuming.
And with all of those platforms and programs in mind, is it a case where you need to learn all of this new technology and these skills like on-location editing, for example, before you go?
Yes, and I've got, you know, a whole bunch of lessons with people to teach me the technology that's involved, and you know, and that's a big part of it. But I think really the biggest issue is coming to terms with when is a story from Europe really tip over the line into becoming something important for an Australian audience, and it's not something that you want to judge on parochial terms about when is something, I don't know, fascinating for potentially gratuitous reasons, but when is it important? When do we really need to know that an economy is on the precipice or a political change is nigh? Those kinds of nuanced judgments are the things that I'm really going to be working hard at learning.
And that's, of course, on a journalistic level. But what about on a personal level with the family, for example? I imagine it's quite a big deal for them making the move.
Yeah, I've got two young children and a missus. And so, yeah, it's a force 12 hurricane. That's what it is.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the logistical mountain that we climbed to get our you know what it's like moving out of a house. Well, trying to move into a shipping container is a whole other beast. But look, it's all in good fun, and the children were very funny because they had been begging for ages to go on an aeroplane somewhere. And so when I got the job, I was excited, and I said, "Kids, you know how you've been wanting to go on a plane?" And they eyes lit up, and they said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, how would you like to go to London?" And they kind of high fived, and they're all excited. Good. And my wife gave me a look, and then I said, "For 3 years."
And still excited, I take it.
They're still excited. They're still excited. The penny dropped for the older boy, and he piped up and said, "So does that mean we'll be going to school over there?" And that's when the reality, I think, set in.
Bad news, kids. School is still part of the equation. Can I ask, finally, your specialty is in investigative journalism, and ABC audiences would know your work with Four Corners, not to mention Fairfax before that. Is it a challenging transition moving from that in-depth journalism that can take months and months to covering the news of the day, often with those very tight deadlines?
Absolutely. I think there are some instincts that I have from having had the privilege of doing that work that will always be useful about, you know, asking the question that hopefully other people aren't asking and getting an answer to it. But yes, it's logistically impossible to do the vast volumes of research that I'm used to doing. You know, you'd at the end of every Four Corners program, you'd really have enough for a book or half a book on the topic. So I think it's being smarter about how much do I need to know before I have to move on to the next disaster or the next political conflagration.
Linton Besser, congratulations and all the best for your posting.
Thank you so much.
Linton Besser, our new Europe correspondent, who'll be based in London. Japan's preparations to host next year's Rugby World Cup are gearing up, with a new stadium opening in the country's northeast. But for the residents of Kamiishi, it's more than just an arena.
It's a permanent reminder of the town's strength and a memorial for one of the hardest hit areas from the tsunami 7 years ago. The rugby-mad city was badly affected, and locals hope the stadium will help the city rebound from the disaster. And as our North Asia correspondent Jake Sturmer reports, the town also has a strong Australian connection.
As local children play with professionals inside the Kamaishi Unosumai Memorial Stadium, locals watch on with pride. What was a school is now a symbol of the city's recovery. This man says he wasn't expecting such a magnificent stadium, and it's good for Kamaishi. This woman says she hopes many people learn about Kamaishi through this stadium and that it helps the city rebound from the disaster. That disaster was the devastating 2011 tsunami. Much of the city and its surrounding coast were destroyed. More than 1,000 people were killed. Rugby is a big part of this community and a popular sport here. One of the safe places in the city during the tsunami was the clubhouse of the local Kamaishi Sea Waves rugby team. That's where Australian professional rugby player Scott Fardy fled.
The way I explained to people was like a jet engine getting started outside your apartment. So I heard something off in the distance, because if you've been in an earthquake, it's like it comes from the distance. So it's like gets closer and closer. You feel the rattling. And this one kind of, I thought someone was about to drive a truck into the side of the building or something, where it might, and then bang, it just exploded into the house and things were flying off the walls and TV was rattling around and everything like that.
Fardy was living in the town, having signed with the Sea Waves.
The guys coming up from the foreshore and telling us what had gone down, you know, down the front of the town, and realising, you know, the seriousness of the situation. You know, earthquakes happen all the time in Japan, but the tsunami was probably the more serious aspect of it.
But when the offer to evacuate the town came, he and a few of his foreign teammates stayed put, instead opting to help the community recover, unloading trucks, doing whatever was necessary.
When it comes to a sporting team like the Kamaishi Sea Waves, you're very integrated with the community, so you end up feeling really part of it. And you know, if you're playing alongside guys, the fact that, you know, they've got nowhere to go and you're saying, I'm going to go back to Australia, I wasn't going to sit well with us, sort of thing. So, you know, we decided to stay because, you know, we felt like we could also help as well at that point. You know, we sent kind of the women and children home, and then we could be of assistance to the people around the town if we could.
His professional career took him around the world. He left Japan at the end of 2011 and is currently playing with Irish side Leinster. But he did come back to visit in March.
Yeah, it was a real spin out. It was fantastic to see just the rebuild. You know, when I kind of left, things were just pretty much just getting cleaned up. Things in the city weren't really opening. Now, you know, obviously the city centre's come back to life. It's the centre of the community, and there's brand new buildings and new cafes. And obviously very sad to see some of the old buildings not there, but, you know, happy to see the town on the way back up.
Melanie Brock, an Australian who's lived in Japan for more than 25 years, was in the city of Kamaishi. She's a senior advisor working for Rugby Australia ahead of next year's World Cup. She says it was bittersweet during the actual opening of the stadium.
You know, many people have been worried, I guess, at different points, been concerned if this is the right way to sort of whether they should be creating something, a new stadium in a place where a lot of people still haven't got, you know, out of the temporary facilities, etc. But I think those fears and those concerns were very much put aside, because it was a truly very emotional, but a beautifully gentle and terrific day for children and for people who love rugby, which is basically the town of Kamaishi.
Kamaishi's stadium will host two matches in next year's World Cup, and the arena will serve as a permanent reminder of how rugby helped to rebuild a devastated city. This is Jake Sturmer in Tokyo for Correspondence Report.
That's all from Correspondence Report this week. I'm Thomas Ariti. My thanks to technical producer David Lawford. Join us at the same time next week for more thoughts and stories from the ABC's foreign correspondents. Now it's back to you, Hugh.
Thomas, thank you.